You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
We need him. As we look at a whole year before us, the truth I have for you this morning is you need him. And if you can live out of that place of need this year, this place of dependence and surrender, I promise you, friends, it will change everything. That no matter what comes, if you will live out of that truth that we need him, that we are not capable on our own, it changes everything. So I want to lead you in a prayer this morning, and some of you will know this. You can go ahead and close your eyes. This is a prayer that people do all over the world, and it's called the Palms Up, Palms Down prayer. And so the first part, I want you to hold your hands out and just put your palms facing down. And we do this as a symbol that there are some things that we need to let go of. In order to need God, in order to surrender to him in this year, there are some things that you've got to let go of that you can't carry with you into 2017. And so I want to give you a moment now to just offer those things to the Father. Ask in your mercy that you will take these things, that we will let them go, that you will give us that grace to not hold on to them any longer, that we will recognize that some burdens are too heavy for us to carry, but we know one who tells us, cast all my cares, all of our cares on you because you care for us. And so, Lord, may we give you those things this morning. And now if you'll place your palms face up, because there are some things that God needs to give to you. What word from him does he want to say to you as you enter a new year? And so we'll just wait for a few moments together. Lord, we just ask that in this year, Father, that we would turn to you. Lord, that we would expect to hear from you. And sometimes you speak to us through other believers, and sometimes you just come with your own divine word for us. But Lord, I thank you that you are always willing to speak when we will slow down and listen. When we will let go and ask for your help, you are always there. And so in 2017, may we learn to trust you in new and powerful and profound ways. God, may we live this year in that truth that we need you. And I pray these things in the strong name of your son, Jesus. And together, all God's people say, amen.
So, today is traditionally in the church calendar called Epiphany. And so, what we're going to be talking about today is celebrating what's sometimes called the Day of the Three Kings. To start that off, though, I wanted to kind of tell a story. I was reading a really fascinating story the other day, and it was this woman who was very successful, you'd all know her, who was speaking to a group of Harvard alums, and she was talking about the value and merits of failure and how failure in her life had been sort of a gift to her. And here's what she said. I put it up so that everyone can see. She says, eventually, we all must come to a decision for ourselves about what represents failure. However, the world is very keen to put failure on a schedule and give you a set of decisive factors if you allow it. A meager 7 years following my graduation, failure had hit me on a grand scale. A fleeting marriage was dissolved, I had no job, I was single parent, and as destitute as anyone could possibly be without living on the streets. My parents' fears for me and those I had for myself had finally transpired, and according to the book of failure, I was the biggest. And the person who shared this, addressing these Harvard alums, was a lady by the name of J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books. Many consider the history's first billionaire author. Crazy, huh? And her point is that failure is actually not unusual. It's actually kind of common. Failure's pretty normal, and in her case, it might be considered a gift as it led to her starting to write and take a stab at that as a career. And gifts are kind of like that. They don't appear to be what they could be at the beginning. They look like something else. But really, if we give them time, they're God's way of guiding us. They're God's way of growing us up. They're God's way of helping us face challenges. It's like Harry Potter in the Chamber of Secrets facing Lord Voldemort. You guys know where I'm going with this? No, let me help you out. So Harry Potter is in the Chamber of Secrets facing Tom Riddle, a.k.a. Lord Voldemort, a.k.a. he who must not be named. And he's facing him, bravely trying to handle imminent death. And two gifts come his way. And it's Dumbledore's pet phoenix carrying an old sorting hat. And Tom Riddle laughs at Harry Potter and says, "Is this what Dumbledore, the best thing he has to offer you? A moldy old hat and a songbird?" Harry didn't know what those gifts were for. But you know what? He reaches in the sorting hat. He pulls out the Sword of Gryffindor. Okay, that happened. And then when the big basilisk snake comes out and tries to eat him, the phoenix goes up and pokes his eyes out. He takes the Sword of Gryffindor, puts it through the roof of the basilisk's mouth. All right, he dies. He gets stabbed with venom, but the phoenix tears heal him. He takes one of the fangs, and then he goes through the diary, which, by the way, is a horcrux where you find out in book 6, Harry Potter and the Half-Blooded Prince. And then Voldemort is dead. He's defeated. Two things. Number one, I love the Harry Potter novels, and I don't care who knows it. Other than the Bible, I'm more familiar with those books than any other book, and it's marginal difference. Second, gifts are not always what they appear to be. They're just not. Rowling said at some point, we must determine for ourselves what failure looks like, and on this day where we celebrate the Magi and their gifts, I would kind of like put a spin on that. We also must determine what we consider a gift, because sometimes there are things we don't think are gifts that really are. So we're going to be going through the story of the Magi in Matthew chapter 2. So if you want to flip over there. So Epiphany, technically, is 12 days after Christmas. So on the church calendar, it is January 6th, but since we're here on January 1, together already, we're going to celebrate Epiphany today. And this is the day where the ancient church has celebrated the arrival of the Magi as they greeted young Jesus with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So I'm going to start in Matthew chapter 2. And we're going to go through this passage. It's about 12 verses. And then after that, I'd like to make a couple observations about the nature of gifts. Okay? All right, so Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where's the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." All right, first, we are introduced here to the Magi. Notice they aren't called kings and there aren't three of them. You notice that right off the bat? You know, where do we get that? So early Christians started saying that they were kings, even though they weren't. They were magi, which is a completely different kind of role. But Psalm 72 says, all kings will bow down to him. So over time, that kind of like morphed into, oh, the kings. And we don't know how many there were. In fact, the Eastern tradition says there were 12 of them. It's the Western tradition that says that there's three based upon the fact that there were three gifts. And magi obviously does not mean kings. It comes from the Greek word magos, which means magician, wizard. So opening a sermon on Epiphany with a Harry Potter story is not only permissible, it's theologically appropriate. All right? And in the East, magi were leading figures in the religious court. They were relied upon for the wisdom and diplomacy matters. They were relied upon for their knowledge in the ancient world, what would be scientific matters in their study of astrology. And so, which leads us to this fascinating supposed star. Now, these magi weren't just like looking in the sky and then decided to follow some weird phenomenon, right? They had some context. They would have been familiar with the Hebrew scriptures. There were plenty of Jewish settlements out in the Babylonian area, which is where they came from, that kind of part of the world, because there were a lot of Jews left over from the exile. So they probably would have been very familiar with the Hebrew scriptures. They could have read right there. You can see, notice how they asked Herod explicitly, "Where is the one who's been born King of the Jews?" Like, that didn't come out of the air. They knew about that, and they A star couldn't have told them that. They found that in the Hebrew Torah. Because in Numbers, it actually says a star will come out of Jacob, a scepter will rise in the east. But what was the star? I mean, a lot of people really speculate about that. There's a very well-known documentary that's been out. It's called The Star of Bethlehem. And they argue that it was likely this unusual alignment of planets that happened around 7 BC. And then there's other people who say, well, if you look at some of the Korean and Chinese astrologers, they talk about the supernova that happened around 5 BC. But I think we should also be open to supernatural explanations. Maybe not. Maybe it wasn't a natural star. And I'm not saying it wasn't a star. I'm not saying it wasn't a supernova. I'm only saying that it's our culture who's obsessed with science. We're the ones who want to put a scientific explanation on everything. We study astronomy. They studied astrology. Very different. And they saw stars in the ancient world. It's like the mysterious heavens. And if God can lead the Israelites with a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, why could he not lead the wise man with a supernatural star or even an angel? Because in the Bible, angels are often referred to as stars. So we're talking about a bunch of magi traveling months, following something in the heavens to find the long prophesied Messiah. Do we really need to get all scientific to make the story credible? You know what I mean? It's unbelievable no matter what you put on it. And I think, once again, I'm not saying it wasn't a supernova or whatever. I'm only saying that scientific explanations don't, you know, they're sometimes cool, but they don't remove the need for faith. I think that, I don't know if you found that, sometimes it's our modern church's desire. We want to put some scientific thing on it to give it credibility. And people outside of the faith are like, it's still incredibly unbelievable, right? And that's where we all have to go, you know what? Faith. Faith. Verse 3. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least amongst the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. You kind of see his eyebrow raised. The Magi, they're in their entourage, talk with Herod. And you need to know, Herod's a nasty dude. He's just historically speaking, all our records say that he was just ruthless. And at this time in his life, it's kind of towards the end of his reign. And he was famously, just notoriously paranoid. Everyone was out to overthrow him. Everyone out was to take his power. He had family members killed. All kinds of things, nastiness happened. And so it's no wonder that all Jerusalem got disturbed when he got disturbed. Because when he was disturbed, bad things seemed to happen to everyone around him. Still, he had incentive to learn more about this king of the Jews that was born, right? Notice he didn't challenge their belief that a king was born, right? He's like, I accept your conclusion. So what does he do is he helps narrow down their search by calling in the priests, the scribes, and they help narrow it down to, okay, it's in this town, Bethlehem. But immediately we see the duplicity of Herod. He says, I too want to come worship the king. Everyone else knew that Herod's not like that. Herod's a paranoid freak. He's going to remove this threat. But the Magi weren't aware of like local political matters, so they had no reason not to trust him. Verse 9. After they had heard the king, they went on their way. And the star they had seen when it rose ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. So if you remember, an angel appeared to Joseph in a dream to tell him that it was okay to marry Mary, his impregnated fiance, whom he was not the father of the child. In the same way, the Magi had some sort of dreams in which they were warned of Herod's duplicity because they weren't aware of it. And so they went back another route. And the Magi only had to travel 6 miles from Jerusalem to get to Bethlehem. That's all they had to go. And somehow, a star rested over Jesus' location, which for me is evidence that says this is probably more of a supernatural thing than a natural thing, because I don't know about you, but stars in the heavens don't necessarily help me go 6 miles. Does that make sense? It just seems kind of odd. Either way, it could be either way. It could be scientific. It could be supernatural. I don't even know that matters. Okay. The word for child here in the Greek is toddler, is for like generally a toddler. And I know most probably know this because we see the manger scenes and the wise men at the manger. But most people know they were not at the manger. Right, look there right in verse 11. Mary and Joseph were living in a house now, right? So it's kind of difficult to reconstruct how old Jesus was, but here's what we know. We know that whatever, something appeared in the sky, and the Magi saw this phenomenon, and however long it took them to decide, we're going to follow this, plus that several-month journey, plus however long they were in Jerusalem trying to figure out what to do next, that all is at least how long Jesus was alive. And the next thing we know is that Herod famously ordered after this to have all children under the age of 2 to be slaughtered. And so, remember him asking when the star appeared? He was doing math of his own. And so, most scholars would agree that Jesus was between 1 and 2 years old when they arrived. And so they come and they find this baby Jesus. And they bring him 3 gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But I want to look at the entirety of this story, considering what the gifts are. You know, obviously we talk about these 3 gifts. Gold is very valuable in the ancient world. Frankincense, or just maybe incense would be a way of saying it, and myrrh were very like luxurious fragrances. They were used for a myriad of reasons. But these 3 obvious gifts are not the only gifts in this story. And so I want to make 3 observations about this story in terms of gifts. So first observation, tests are gifts. Tests are gifts. Have you guys seen these things popping up, like clue rooms, escape room kind of stuff? You seen that? Our staff has been doing those for our staff retreat for the past 2 years. And they're like the most fun ever. Like I can't think of a time when I've had more fun than doing those escape rooms. Like you intentionally go into a room, right, and you're locked in there, and you have to figure out all these puzzles and all these things in order to get out. This last year when we did it, when was that? In Augusty summer? I don't remember. All right, we did it, and we all were working together. We broke up, and the teams were like working on their different puzzles. Communicating with each other, trying to fit together all the clues. We get out of the room. We broke the record. The fastest anyone's ever gotten out of that room, which means we're awesome in every way, shape, and form. And I don't know about you, but when you accomplish something like that, there's this deep feeling of satisfaction, right? A deep feeling of satisfaction. Why? Why is it so fun? Why is it so satisfying? Why would you want to work through a bunch of obstacles that have been intentionally put in your path? That's the nature of a test, right? A bunch of obstacles intentionally put in your path. I suggest that it is what God has put inside of us, a desire to seek. He's put inside of us a desire to seek in order to find. Finding's no fun if there's no seeking involved, right? The finding is so much more satisfying when there's a seeking before it. And it makes me think of King David when he was making a sacrifice to the Lord. I will not give the Lord an offering that costs me nothing. So it's built into us a desire to pursue, to work towards a finish line, seek and find. Tests are gifts. And for the Magi, their journey was definitely a test. They not only had to embrace the physical toll of the trip would take, but they also had to potentially, or they had to embrace that this was all a potential wasted time. They didn't know what was going to be there. They believed there was going to be something, but they had no guarantee that this trip wasn't more than a wild goose chase. The journey was a test of their endurance. It was a test of their faith, and they embraced it. They embraced the seeking. They embraced the journey. And because the seeking was so strenuous, the finding was that much more satisfying. So tests are gifts. Second observation, people are gifts. Now, this one may seem obvious to you, but I have a feeling that most of us apply this truth sparingly. We're like, yeah, some people are gifts. But surely not all of them, right? They're not all gifts. Well, just this week, we had yet another visit from the fire marshals in our building. And this has been a part of my test this past several months. Walking around, and if you ever had conversations with fire marshals over your building, there's just like, they have in their head a thousand codes and rules, and each one kind of looks at those codes and rules differently, and you're like jumping through all these hoops, and I mean, I feel like I'm playing Battleship with them. You know, you do this, I move something out of the hallway, and they're like, miss, or I give them something to show, hey, we're a church that's actually allowed to do events, miss, or I move an extension cord, hits, I'm like, yes, I did something, like, you shunk my battleship, now you're fined, right? It's what it just feels like, oh, it's so frustrating. And so, like, I start thinking about their role in my life, and I have to admit that fire marshals are gifts too, somehow. Because if Judas had a role to play in Jesus' life and he accepted him, I certainly have to make room for fire marshals in mine. And sure, not everyone's going to be like of equal value in our life, right? Not everyone is the same value in terms of being a gift. But for those with eyes to see and those with ears to hear, and the ability to see past the frustrations, the ability to see past the fear, it's simply a matter of perspective. Everyone's a gift. You should try it. Try looking at, that dude Fred, he's a gift. Susie, she's a gift. People are gifts. Now, I think about someone like Herod. He was an unqualified, wicked person. But he, too, was a gift. Were it not for him, the Magi wouldn't have had access to these scholars who helped them narrow down where Jesus was born in Bethlehem. He had a role to play in the Epiphany story. And if we're to follow these two observations that tests are gifts, people are gifts, it could then logically be concluded that people are tests, right? And that's, I'm not going to argue with that one, but that's what my sermon's about. So I'm going to go a different route with my third observation. Gifts are gifts. And what I mean by that is that sometimes the value of gift is not really clear at first. I remember one of the first Christmases I spent with Rachel's family. We went down to where they lived, and they live out in the middle of nowhere. Davy Crockett National Forest is where they grew up, and I was just getting to know her brothers. And it was like this, I felt like this uncomfortable insecurity that we just grew up very differently, very differently. They grew up shooting guns and stuff. I grew up in the suburbs playing video games. They learned how to drive on four-wheelers. I learned how to drive on a golf cart, right? And so it's just very different. And they were both in the Army, and her older brother Josh got me a present that he had bought at the Armor Surplus store on his base, and it was one of those like keychain that has like knives and all kinds of things in it. And he was showing, look, if you do it this way, it turns into scissors. I'm like, cool. I don't carry pocket knives. It's not what I do, right? I remember I put on my keychain. I was like, man, thanks, but I honestly didn't really see the value in it. Well, over the next like 6 months, I used the mess out of that thing. It felt like everywhere I went, someone was like, hey, does anyone have a knife or scissors? I'm like, yes to both. And I pull it out, and it was amazing. This gift, I had no idea was going to be so incredibly valuable to me. At first, I kind of poo-pooed on. It became a real vital part of my life. And do you know what? Gifts are gifts, right? They have deeper value than we could possibly see in the beginning. And if we don't immediately see the value, just wait. Now, the traditional interpretation of gold, frankincense, and myrrh was brought about by Irenaeus, one of the early church fathers, and he would say that the gold represented Jesus' kingship. He would say that the frankincense or the incense represented his deity, because incense was used in religious rituals, and then that the myrrh, which was sometimes used for burial in the ancient world for helping with the smell of decomposing bodies, he would say that represented the death of Jesus. Now, that's a very nice interpretation. However, the Magi had no idea that Jesus was more than some earthly king. So that couldn't have been their intention for the gifts. Mary and Joseph, they didn't know all that stuff was going to go down. So we might see that in hindsight, but it wasn't the intentions of the Magi, and it probably wasn't the interpretation of Mary and Joseph. And I'm sure Mary and Joseph were very honored. Here are these beautiful gifts that are brought to them, the kinds of gifts that would be brought to anyone in royalty. Like, this was a common gift for royalty, but they're not royalty. They're common folk. What do I do with these, right? Is Mary put on the frankincense perfume while she's trying to put food on the table? Well, what they probably didn't know, what none of them could have possibly predicted, was that they would have to flee for their lives soon. And it's very likely all those gifts under the sovereign hand of God provided for them to flee to Egypt and to live there until all that mess of all the kids being killed blew over. We may not always see the value of gifts at first, but they're gifts. Turn with me over to a passage in Philippians. It's towards the ends of your Bibles. It's an interesting passage that Paul pens in his letter to the Philippian church. And Paul had a special relationship with the Philippian church. Maybe one of the churches he was closest to because of how tied they were to him in funding his ministry. He would talk about them as the Macedonian church and how generous they were despite their own poverty. Philippians 4, he writes to them, I'm just going to read verse 14 and 15. He says, "Yet it was good of you to share in my troubles." Once again, that financial, funding his ministry. "Moreover, as you Philippians know, in the early days of your acquaintance with the gospel, when I set out from Macedonia, not one church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, except you only." I find this a fascinating way that Paul phrased this. He didn't just talk about giving, but also the matter of receiving. He didn't just talk about their giving, he talked about both. Because a healthy spirituality will know how to do both. Not only to give, but a healthy spirituality will also know how to receive. Now, in the story of the Magi, we might simply see the Magi as the givers and Mary and Joseph as the receivers. But while I think that's true, I think the Magi also received just as much as they gave. And author William Sidney Porter went by his pen name, O. Henry. And he was an American short story writer. And he wrote this story that he titled The Gift of the Magi. Now, most of you probably have heard some rendition of before. It's been duplicated or copied and kind of told in different ways. But the story focuses on a poor married couple. And they each want to buy meaningful Christmas presents for each other, but they just have almost no money. And between the two of them, there are two valuable possessions in their home. Jim, has his shiny gold pocket watch that belonged to his grandfather, was passed to his father, and now is in his keeping. And then she has, her name is Della, has God-given long, beautiful hair that goes all the way down to her knees. And on Christmas Eve, Della has $1.87 in her hand, and she is frantic, desperate to find the perfect gift for her beloved husband. And she sees this platinum-like chain that would go perfect with his watch. So she goes to a hairdresser and has her hair cut, gets $20 for it, and buys the chain. She runs home excited, knowing that she got the perfect gift for him, wondering to herself if Jim will still think she's pretty. Jim arrives home uncharacteristically late, and he steps in, he sees her, and he just stops and stares. It's like all her hair's gone. She says, "I had to cut it to buy your gift, Jim." And he gives her his gift. She opens it up, and it's an assortment of beautiful combs that are now useless because she doesn't have hair. She said, "No matter, here's my gift." He opens up the chain and admits he had to sell his pocket watch in order to buy the combs. So the moral of the story is that while both Jim and Dell are now left with supposedly useless gifts, they now realize how far each of them are willing to go to express their love for one another. And I love how O. Henry ends this short story. He says, "The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the newborn king of the Jews. They invented the art of Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat who most wisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these two were the wisest. Of all who give and receive gifts, such as they are the wisest. Everywhere they are wisest. They are the Magi." Let's do a little practice. Turn to your neighbor and say, "You're a gift." Tell other people around you too, not just one person. Everyone's a gift, right? Thanks, brother. Now turn to them and say, "I receive you." See, like this year, I hope it's a year where you give great gifts. You know, I hope this is a year where you feel like your ability to bless others is meaningful and thoughtful and impacts other people's lives. But even more than that, I pray that this year is a year that you not only give well, but you receive well. I pray that this is a year when you begin to see that tests are gifts. People are gifts. Gifts are gifts. God is everywhere giving us gifts. And I know that story, the gift of the Magi, what it really says to me is that the physical gift really isn't the primary part of the gift. The primary part of the gift is the heart of the one who gave it. And Jesus said, "You know, you, though you're evil, who know how to give good gifts to your kids, how much more does your heavenly Father know how to give good gifts to those who ask?" I know some of us want to roll our eyes to say tests are gifts, and some of those people are gifts, but the heart of the Father helps us see past the fear, past the frustration, that gifts are gifts. They bless me. They guide me. They help me face obstacles. And I would like to just pray a prayer over our hearts that we might be the kinds of people that see gifts everywhere. Father, I pray over our faith community, everyone in this room and everyone couldn't make it this morning. I just pray that your spirit would open our eyes to see your gifts all around. Help us see not just the big gifts, but the small ones. We wake up and we hear a bird singing. Don't let us just move on past that. Help us hear that and acknowledge that it's a gift. When people are frustrating us and we feel that kind of that anxiety and that resistance, help us to put that to the side for just a moment to see pass and go, there's a gift there somewhere, and to acknowledge it. I pray that 2017 is a year where we are overwhelmed with gratitude. God, help us to grow in gratitude, to see so many things. Maybe even sit down at the end of a day and write out everything we're grateful for that happened in that day. Because I strongly believe, Lord, that as you build in us this gratitude, that will turn us into the kind of generous people you want us to be. We will not be givers out of obligation or duty. We will be givers out of our great gratitude, this unending flow that you pour into us that we receive and then are able to pour into others. So open our hearts, open our eyes, open our ears. May we see your gifts everywhere. So now to him who is able to keep you from falling, to present you before his glorious presence without fault and with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, be glory, power, majesty throughout all the ages, forevermore. Everyone says, boom. Love you guys.